It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear. Here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day from Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Online with me, I have Lisa Hajar. She's professor in the sociology department at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's co-editor of the new journal, Jadalia. She's going to help me with that. And it's jadalia.com. That's jadalia.com. Now, the reason that I wanted to speak with Lisa, she recently wrote an article, Omar Suleiman, the CIA's man in Cairo and Egypt's torturer in chief. Okay. Now, she's also author of Courting Conflict, the Israeli Military Court System in the West Bank and Gaza, that will be of interest, and working on a book about the anti-torture lawyering in the United States. So she definitely, I would imagine, has an opinion about what's going on in Egypt. Do you have an opinion, Lisa?
Yes, I do. Well, I think what's happened in the last 48 hours or 72 hours has been a wonderful way to end a 30-year dictatorship. However, there is a lot left to be done. And as you mentioned, Omar Suleiman, remains in power despite his ignominious legacy as, Egypt's principal torturer for international prisoners brought in internationally.
Okay, now let's go ahead. I want to, we got an hour, so we're going to go ahead and try and get down some nitty-gritty. We've been having a lot of people on the show discussing what's going on in Egypt. Let me cut to the chase, give you my opinion, and I want to see how far off I am from your opinion. So we're not going to sugarcoat it here. This is a hardcore, no-compromise, libertarian, anarchist type show. Freedom's the answer. What's the freaking question? Okay? I am of the opinion that throughout certainly modern day, last couple of hundred years of Egypt, since Napoleon back in 1798 was there doing his invading, since then, there has always been a Western influence and or direct control of the government in Egypt. Even after the Cairo fires in 1952, when the people, the British tried to, Suez Canal zone's all ours and go away and we'll machine gun you and you can't play and whatever. And the people rioted. From that moment on, it's always been some kind of a modern-day Egypt where you got Naib or whatever his name was, Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak, and it always seems that every time you go through these transitional governments that it comes right back to the West being in control, if not majorly influencing. And when you're giving somebody $60 billion over, three decades, I am of the opinion that, he's your boy. So you look at Omar, and I'm going, and he would be different in what way?
Well, in fact, I'll correct you on one point. The period from the Free Officers' Revolution in 1952 until, during the whole reign of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Egypt was among the non-aligned countries, like led the non-aligned movement, and consequently was much more took arms, et cetera, from the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc because, particularly after 67, the United States increased its foreign and military aid to Israel. However, it was after Nasser died and Sadat came to power and particularly after the 1973 war, when President Anwar Sadat decided to shift Egypt's alliance back towards the West, that you then see a kind of a rekindling of those relationships. And it was as a result of the Egypt's unilateral effort to, initiate peace talks with Israel in 1977 that led to the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty that solidifies, in a sense, Egypt's relationship to the United States and the amount of aid that Egypt receives from the United States, which is proportionally linked to the amount of aid that Israel receives from the United States.
Really? So it's proportional. Let me go ahead and get clarification on one thing. When I say Egypt, what am I really talking about? I'm not really talking about the sands of the Sahara. What I'm talking about is the Suez Canal. Okay.
No, actually, you're talking about the Nile Valley, and the vast majority of Egypt's population lives Alexandria down through the Nile, and Cairo is there. The Suez, is geostrategically important, but that's not a significant locus for Egyptian domestic politics.
Okay, let me go ahead and ask this question. From 1952 to 77, when we started getting into Camp David and so on, who controlled the Suez Canal?
Well, there was a war in 1956. In fact, President Nasser, in coming to power after deposing the free officers, deposed the king, they basically wanted, as many countries did in their post-colonial period, wanted to nationalize major resources and institutions. And so Nasser moved to nationalize control of the Suez Canal rather than having foreigners controlling it. And as a result of that, Britain, France, and Israel aligned together and attacked Egypt in order to reverse the effort to nationalize the Suez Canal. And ironically, it was the administration of Dwight Eisenhower in cooperation with the Soviet Union that essentially forced Britain, France, and Israel back out of the canal zone and allowed Egypt to nationalize and control the Suez Canal in 1956.
Okay, are they now that held?
Yes, yes. When Sadat, once the peace treaty with Sadat, with Israel came, Sadat very much moved Egypt, and Mubarak has moved Egypt even more so, into the kind of neoliberal, multinational, capitalist model. So now, one can say that there is a great deal of Western penetration in Egypt, but it's primarily along sort of corporate, global, multinational types of interests. But Egypt,
okay, now, let me ask this question. Now that you're of the mind that Egypt really is the Nile Valley.
That's where all the population resides.
Okay. Well, yeah, they're not living in the desert. All right. So my point is this. If you have Egypt where you got 17, 20 million people living just in Cairo out of 80 million people there, I'm going, all right, well, I'm sure most of the people, Nile Valley, that's where they're at. Do they care about the Suez Canal?
Absolutely. Why? First of all, it's a source of, it's territorial. Do we care about Texas? Do people in California care about Texas? Yes, it's part of the United States.
Okay, now, this is the point. I want to get the personal importance of the Suez Canal. You just say, nope, it's Nile Valley. And I'm going, okay, well, the Suez Canal have anything to do with that? Well, okay, I need to know, because that was the attempt before. Every attempt has always been, because a lot of people don't know, the Suez Canal has been around since the 1860s. This is a long time ago. So we're, 130, 40 years ago. So I'm going, wow, man, that's an old piece of real estate. So I would think that the Egyptian people would say, yes, it's ours. Well, there's a lot of other people say, no, we want it to be ours to the point that we're willing to machine gun you. We're willing to invade you. We're willing to have tanks and fighter jets. So I'm going, all right. So the Suez Canal is important enough that it is seen and felt as part of Egypt, correct?
Well, it is part of Egypt. In some ways, it boosts Egypt's international significance because of the importance of the Suez Canal as a, transit for the movement of goods, across the globe. The Suez.
Okay, we're going to talk about when we come back with Lisa Hajar, because it's just like Panama. Do you think the U.S. doesn't have influence there? Well, who has influence in the Suez Canal? and how about it manifests in the future? We're going to find out with Lisa Hajar when we come back in just a little bit.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. My special guest, Lisa Hajar from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and she has an opinion on the Middle East. Now, this is where I'm going. I'm trying to build up, trying to get an understanding because of this one simple thing. The Panama Canal here that separates or allows us to bisect with big giant ships, the South America and North America, has the same kind of impact. Big giant commercial, oh my goodness, we want to ship it from anywhere in Asia, the Persian Gulf, whatever, through to go to Europe, goes right through Suez Canal. They got to go all the way around the Horn of Africa. Heck no. And this has been such an important thing that even in the early days of steam machinery, I mean, it was back in the day that they did, and I think I'm right. I think it was, I remember it was right after the Civil War here in the United States in the late 60s, early 70s of 1800s is when they opened the Suez Canal. And it's been a point of contention ever since. So, and even before that. Now, Egypt is an ancient culture. It's not like they, haven't gone through their cycles of pharaohs and somebody wants to rule them. And they're evolving, certainly with the internet, with the concept of, hey, can we go in ourselves? My contention is this. Throughout history, Egypt as a point of commerce for Asia, the Middle East, Europe, Africa. I mean, man, they have been blessed with a strategic location that is perfect for being a hub of commerce for these areas. And they have the Nile Delta. That flood, that annual flooding, well, now with the dam and so on, it supports the Nile River Valley. Tens of millions of people can have a quality of life that normally they would not. So this makes one of the reasons, oh, I got a bee in here. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, now, this is interesting because for thousands and thousands of years, this has been a thriving metropolis. Now, I look at this one point. If the United States was not comfortable with the ultimate control and or we get to use the Panama Canal, it never would have went back to Panama. I am of the same opinion that people with big giant guns, big giant tanks, many airplanes and aircraft carriers, there is no way in heck that they would even say Egypt gets to have control over the Suez Canal if they thought for a nanosecond that they weren't going to get total and complete access to that canal. Now, I make that statement, Lisa, and I just want to know how far off am I?
Well, I mean, there's nothing contentious about the Suez Canal, regardless of what kind of government Egypt would have. Every government wants to ensure that the Suez Canal continues to be a means through which shipping can go. During the revolution over the last several weeks, the Suez Canal workers did go on strike for several days, but as a means, contributing to the large demonstrations to pressure for the toppling of the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. But there is no, the Suez Canal is not a point of contention. I mean, its, continued operations are, going to be in the interest of any Egyptian government, regardless of, who's in power or what the nature of the regime is. So Suez Canal, safe, fine, no problem.
Okay, let me ask this question, a simple question. When they went on strike, some of the workers and everything, did it curtail, stop,
yes,
or slow down?
Yes,
oh, man,
days.
People don't like that.
Well, but the whole point was the issue was to topple the regime of Hosni Mubarak and to, create enough domestic pressure. So the workers in Suez, as workers in other parts of the country beyond Cairo itself, were participating in the revolution, a domestic pressure to force Hosni Mubarak to step down. So it was a tactic, a short-lived one, and ultimately in conjunction with the actions of people in Cairo, Alexandria, and elsewhere. It succeeded in toppling.
No. I understand. Of course, they did. That was the intent. That's what they did. And the fact that they were able even to accomplish that for 2 days, I guarantee that is not lost on people that had ships that wanted to go through there during that time. Now, Omar Suleiman, why do you think that they would pick him to succeed Mubarak? Because he's just, what, you think he's less in control of whoever wants to control?
No. Let me put to give your listeners a little bit of a background, just to say who Omar Suleiman was, and let's dial, go back a couple of weeks or years. Omar Suleiman, like many people, Mubarak as well, came up politically through the ranks of the army. I mean, Nasser came up through the army, Sadat came up through the army. So Suleiman in 1993 was appointed to be the head of the General Intelligence Services, which is Egypt's equivalent of the CIA. But in Egypt, that's, a portion, it's under the auspices of the military. So from 1993 until January 29th, when he was promoted to vice president, he was somebody who was in charge of a very important element of the Egyptian state. Now, Suleiman was, did have aspirations to succeed Mubarak and was a real enemy of Mubarak's son, Gamal Mubarak. And so there was a real split politically within Egypt between the kind of crony capitalists found around Mubarak, people who were willing to sell off pieces of Egypt to multinational corporations to enrich themselves, and people like Suleiman, who, and many other generals who are also capitalists, but who wanted to essentially see Egypt developing an economy that would be strong enough to, prevent the kind of instability, the poverty that led to the revolution. But, Suleiman's claim to fame and why, Mubarak was shrewd in appointing him was because of the fact that he was the CIA's man in Cairo. I mean, he was somebody who helped since the Clinton administration develop certain kinds of bilateral cooperations in dealing with Islamist terrorism. And under the Bush administration, he was an active participant in facilitating America's extraordinary rendition program, which was where the CIA would kidnap people from places around the world, either disappear them into CIA secret prisons called black sites, or transfer them to third countries for torture by proxy. And Egypt was a favorite torture destination, and Suleiman was really the person who was very much involved in torturing.
Oh, he personally tortured people, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he tortured at least two people personally, but everyone who was extraordinarily rendered into Egypt, and this was, numbered in the dozens, was, certainly in the constant attention of Suleiman, since he was, doing this at the behest of the United States.
Okay, so he gets to be number two. I'm number two. Now I'm number one. Okay.
Well, he's not number one. He was. What happened, actually, what's really interesting is that not only was Suleiman a rival of Mubarak's son Gamal, but he was also a rival of the defense secretary and the head of the army, which is Hussein Tantawi. And in the night when Mubarak was supposed to step down, Mubarak and Suleiman together, hoodwinked the military and said they wouldn't step down. And the following morning, that was when the military basically forced Mubarak to leave. And Tantawi is now, sort of the buck stops at Tantawi now.
Okay, well, that's what we're going to find out when we come back. Who's in charge? It's martial law. That's who's in charge of guys with the guns. We'll find out when we come back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
For here in Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com. Online with me is Lisa Hajar. She's professor in the sociology department at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And she I recently wrote about Omar Suleiman as the CIA's man in Cairo and Egypt's torturer in chief. Well, he kind of got looked over. He got bypassed. He was close, and then all of a sudden, he doesn't get to play. Now, what we do have is the military has finally asserted their authority in the terms of, you know, we got soldiers and guns and artillery and tanks and other kinds of goodies, and we say, you know what? We're in charge now. We declare martial law. We clear out the square. Everybody's gone, and now they're starting to come back. People saying, no. You seriously? You think we think this is over? We think that you guys are going to have martial law, and all of a sudden it's going to be all good without our influence? Heck no. So that's what I want to talk to Lisa about now. So what we have now in Egypt is what?
Well, I mean, let me just to clarify one thing. Within all of the institutions of the Egyptian state, the military has been, you know, historically relatively popular and had enjoyed a lot of legitimacy. I mean, the police had no legitimacy because they, you know, brutally tortured, you know, Egyptians routinely. The, you know, the interior ministry had no legitimacy. One reason the military has been so popular and legitimate, relatively speaking, is that it's a conscription army. So, I mean, it really is the army of the people. Now, what's going on now, in a sense, was that the army had, the military had, you know, by promising not to fire on protesters, you know, while we can quibble about what this meant, ultimately it was the army's unwillingness to join with the police to try and crush the protesters that actually brought, you know, forced the regime to come down. Now, what we don't, it's difficult to predict now, but there's a, you know, there's an armed Supreme Council of top military commanders, including Tantawi, including, you know, Suleiman is on this as well. And they're basically trying to strategize how to, you know, rewrite the Constitution, how to authorize elections, which they said will come in 6 months, and so on. What the, I think, you know, the question, however, is that the protesters want to make sure that the military is taking demands for robust democracy into account as they start try to, you know, move from here. But let me just say that, you know, Egypt, you know, the fact that the military is now running the show isn't new in, as far as emergency law. I mean, the country has been under continuous emergency law for 30 years. So,
well, when do you finally come to the conclusion that, you know, they shouldn't be in charge anymore? Now, they're giving themselves 6 months, and we're going to have, so that puts us, see, we're mid-February, so that puts us in, what, mid-July or something?
Right.
So you're going, okay, so by this summer, and Cairo and Phoenix, you know, share a lot of geography, you know? I know it's in the middle of July. It's freaking hot. That's what it is. And I'm going, okay, so it's mid-July. Temperatures and tempers are rising, and there's going to be a lot more activity at night. So they're going to have, they're going to go, you know what? There's a curfew. Is there a curfew under the people right now?
Well, no, I believe that they've lifted the curfew. The fact that demonstrators are going to go back on Friday for a demonstration, whether to celebrate the revolution and, you know, sort of assert a bit of, you know, popular protest. They'll do that on Friday back in Tahrir Square. But no, I think that, you know, the army, and, you know, this is a prediction, but the army has no interest in ruling the country as a military regime. I mean, in other words, what the army itself has been, top officers.
They're a tool officers, of who wants to rule.
I mean, top officers have been able to, you know, enrich themselves greatly by getting involved in your development projects and so on. What the army wants, I think, essentially is to be able to ensure a stable Egypt where the economy can go back to functioning. One interesting thing the army did, you know, and in some ways sort of demonstrating its goodwill to the people, was they, as soon as Mubarak was out of office, they contacted, you know, the Army Supreme Council contacted Switzerland and asked Switzerland to freeze all of Mubarak's, you know, dozens of billions of dollars that are in Switzerland and in the United Kingdom. So that was an effort, you know, essentially to try and repatriate that money back to Egypt to use for, you know, development at a time of, you know, declining.
Lisa, you got to help me out here understand this. I mean, I got the stories up right now in Freedom's Phoenix to where they're calling up the reservist. The military has declared martial law. They've given themselves, as of now. Now, think about it.
What paper are you reading, by the way?
Let's take a look. This is Fox News.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get any. You can't get serious news from Fox.
Okay.
Well, why don't you go to a reliable source?
Well, let's go ahead and see what it has to say here. The Egyptian army today called up thousands of military reservists as soldiers cleared Tahrir Square, the epicenter of the extraordinary revolution, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I'll give you that. You know, I'm not going to base my you know, life on Fox News. But, you know, the thing is they're calling up reservists. So the thing is the military has just exponentially, you know, gotten stronger. They have more credibility now. They have given themselves 6 months of military martial law rule. So I'm going, now let me finish. What is going to replace it in your mind? Are the people really, because they're going, well, we're going to have elections. We'll have fair and honest elections. Hell, I can't get that here in the U.S. So I'm going, you know, the Egyptians, are they going to have some kind of faith in a new electoral process? Well, then here comes the international community. To give credibility to whatever it is that we're going to put in place, we're going to come in with international observers. We're going to go in. We're going to pinky swear. You know, we have all kinds of purple fingers. And I'm going, you know, I see this is what I'm building up to. I see more of exactly the same thing that's going to happen to Egypt as has happened for the last 200 years. Now, the people, they may not accept it. They may go, yeah, we know better, and the internet helps make that possible. But I see a military rule in place with the support of the people, at least not the direct opposition, as of now. When it starts getting hot, and it's already starting to get hot here in Phoenix now, and I'll bet you it's starting to, you know, within weeks it's going to start getting warm in Cairo. They are going to want to do a lot more of their activities when it's not so blazingly freaking hot at night. Sooner or later, within the next 3-4 months, I guarantee, well, my assumption is curfew is going to be hit again. And if they don't have reasons, legitimate reasons, they will create them. So I'm going, by July, we are going to have elections, you would hope. They are going to, in your estimation, be, you know, legitimate, accurate, represent the people. Are they going to have the people? What about the people that say, how about we don't have a rule? I tell you what we want. We want to have an election to where the provinces, the states, the smaller communities rule themselves, and there is no federal government. We want to have this. We want to have. There's going to be certain parameters, like Hillary Clinton's been saying, coming out going, oh, no, we can't have a void. We got to have it structured the way we want it so that we can deal with them, so we can be served by we all the way home. So I'm going, okay, your assumption is you're happy with the way it's going or you're not. You think the military is going to give up power or it's not. They're going to do it in name only or it's going to be a true civilian-run government. And is it going to have outside country influences? So I'm looking 6 months down the road. What do you see is going to be in place and how is it going to get there?
Well, what's happening right now, I mean, in other words, the reason why they're projecting and you know, promising elections in July is because they have, you know, as soon as the army took over, Mubarak was, you know, sort of removed. In fact, he was removed. He was refusing to leave, and the military threatened to put him on trial for treason if he didn't fly off to Sharm el-Sheikh. So, you know, in some ways, what the military did immediately, you know, is they are the functional state at the moment, but they have been already in the process of drawing on different elements of the opposition.
Well, we're going to find out when we come back what those elements are and what influence they're going to have. Because all I got to do is wait. I know what's going to happen.
Roads? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Yeah, one goal here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona. How about some truth, justice, and what used to be the American way, where the heck that was? You know, let's go ahead and try for that Truth and Justice. Let's do that. And, you know, we'll sprinkle some freedom in there because that's what you got to have. You got to have it. Now, people are fighting for it in Egypt right now. They're on the line. They put their lives on the line. I mean, you know, we may, you know, have some great quotes from early patriot Americans. You know, they say, hey, man, you know, we hang together, or we were sure as heck hang separately. Well, they knew exactly firsthand what that meant as they're sitting in, you know, how do I say it? Is it Tahrir? Is that how you say the?
Tahrir.
Yes, exactly. Tahrir Square, they're sitting there going, hey, man, you know, if I leave, if this doesn't succeed, I'd be dead. So, I mean, they were motivated individuals. So they get what they wanted. Mubarak's gone. Say, hey, Mubarak's gone. You know, we got this figurehead. You know, this guy with this fingerprint, this guy's gone now. It's all good. Everybody go home now. Oh, in 6 months, we'll have an election, and pinky swear you'll get what you want or something or whatever. So I'm going, okay, who gets to decide what gets voted on? Because I'm telling you, Lisa, we're talking to Lisa Hajar. She's a professor of sociology department at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and has a lot of writing and something to say about what's going on in Egypt. Now, what I'm asking is, I'm going, look, there is going to be a transition from what is now to whatever is going to be later. And whatever is going to be later, I am of the opinion that for hundreds of years, in just some kind of a self-governing mechanism, whatever it's been through kings, outside of influence, through the, you know, the French, the Ottoman Empire, the British, the French, the United States, I mean, it goes on and on and on and on and on. The common theme has always been that, you know, the people are not in control. Somebody or something else always is. Your opinion and what's going to happen by 6 months from now, are the people are going to be able to assert their sovereignty as individuals, and whatever government is there to defend their individual rights or not? Your opinion.
Well, I think, you know, let me just put, for one thing, I would say that, you know, trying to understand a country by assuming like hundreds of years of continuity is not always the most accurate way. But there have certainly been long periods of, most periods perhaps, of no representation. But let's focus on what's happening now. And just I just checked to see that in the last hour, the Army Supreme Council issued communique number 5. Urging workers to stop striking and go back to work.
Of course they did.
Yeah, which is indicative of the fact, and, you know, for better and worse, the military is, you know, primarily concerned with, you know, sort of restoring stability, maintaining, you know, I think, you know, the sense that Egyptians accomplished something, but most particularly, the top generals are very committed to Egypt's capitalist development and the strengthening of the economy. So in that regard, those are the issues that they're looking to, is to stabilize the country and to actually, like, do something for the economy, hopefully, that is different than the kind of kleptocratic exploitation.
Free the people. You want to stop the kleptocracy. You want to stop all this stuff. Free the people. You don't got to get a license. You don't got to regulate. You don't got to get permission from the government. You don't have to worry about being hauled off to some, you know, secret jail to be tortured if blah, 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 blah. As long as you are not bothering another human being and you're interacting in a free market associate, that's capitalism. I don't know what the heck, you know, their term of capitalist is, a capital that we control. You know, that's not freedom. So if their primary goal is to keep on keeping on and the slaves get back to the mill, you know, I'm going, seriously, you think that's what they wanted? They want to be left alone. There are those that just want to be left alone, them alone.
You really can't, you know, sort of project an American libertarian ideology.
I'll guarantee you, every 14-year-old that you go to, and I put my hand on their shoulder and I say, whose life is this? They're going to say, by the vast majority, you're going to say, it's mine. Or they're not. If it's not their life, then whose is it?
Okay, well, in a country like Egypt, I mean, particularly there are strong trade unions across the country. They've been very active.
That they've given their life over to?
The question now is whether or not and how the trade unions, the Muslim Brothers, the student unions, the women's groups, et cetera, are going to be participating in the formulation of a post-Mubarak transformation. Now, the Constitution itself has been, you know, tossed. And so now, you know, law professors and lawyers across the country and judges, which are, have been very powerful, and in some ways, especially the judges, have been a very performed a very honorable role over the years of authoritarianism, are insistent that they will be at the table.
Of course they
deciding
will.
Deciding on how the new constitution will look. And so this is something I think that nonviolent demonstrations, you know, on Friday and perhaps in the future are going to be keeping the pressure on to ensure that the broad-based, you know, constituencies that made up the revolution will all be able to be represented as Egypt really moves into a new uncharted terrain of a post-authoritarian era.
This is my view, Lisa. This whole thing, Cairo represents the hub of the Arabic community, the entire Middle East. That's where the pop culture is. Movies come out of there. People vacation there. It's kind of a leadership role. It's more secular than a lot of other places. I see, because people keep thinking in terms of the past. I mean, that's a good way to judge the future by the past, but I'm telling you, this is a youth. I looked at Egypt's median age is 24. 24. There's over a third of the people are under 14. I'm going, oh my goodness, you're trying to instill in them, you know, some other, it's going to be this group of organizations going to determine your future and your government. This group, this union, this brotherhood, this, you know, blah, blah. I'm going, did you ever think that of the millions of people in the street, that every single one of those individuals go, you know what? I got a voice and they don't represent it. You know, did that ever cross your mind?
But there is, I mean, Egypt has a very, in fact, perhaps more so than the United States, Egypt has a very well-developed, you know, civil society organizations that, you know, have been able to mobilize sectors of the population. So when they talk about the youth, it's not, I mean, Suleiman, for example, has tried to infantilize protesters by calling, you know, implying that they're like kids who should go home. But youth groups have been extremely sophisticated, and we are learning now that youth groups with their pro-democracy demands were actually collaborating with youth groups in Tunisia for months prior even to the Tunisian revolution. So you see a high level of sophistication among young people. I mean, Egypt does have a relatively high education rate, and that's been one of the, you know, frustrations, is that a lot of people are educated and, you know, potentially organized, and their aspirations have been frustrated, which is different perhaps than other countries. So in other words, they know what the good life might look like, or at least a better life than spending 80% of
and
their
kleptocracy system has taken it away from them. They have 115% increase in wheat. They have 88% increase in corn. And when you're living on a couple of dollars a day, guess what? Man, you go hungry, bow, bow, bow. And I'm telling you, let me say this, Lisa, so that we can look back 6 months from now, we can have you on when this happens, and we can see, you know, where this went, and maybe we can understand why. Because I need your understanding. I need to understand the culture. But this is the operation by what I operate from, a basic understanding of a simple thing. Individuals that are willing to die to be left alone are, I guarantee you, are not there advocating for another shiny badge to be in charge of them.
No, that's
guaranteed.
That's true. But I mean, again, it's like you can't read Egyptian political culture through an American libertarian lens. It's true. People want an end to emergency law and military rule. What they also want an end to, many people, is multinational neoliberalism, the kind of, you know, the thing that has caused vast increases in you know, debt and impoverishment around the world, the kind of Washington consensus, the IMF and the World Bank. That's what people don't want, and that's what has triggered so much of the instability across the region, and well, frankly, will trigger instability in other parts of the world where multinational corporations come in and simply exploit until they can't exploit anymore people for, you know, profits that move back to other countries.
I want everybody in the audience to just pay attention that we've done a lot of stuff on Egypt. And I want to thank Lisa Hajar for coming on from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and helping us with this. But, you know, I tell you what's going to tell the tale. Time is going to pass. And there will be all kinds of reasons, all kinds of excuses of why something happened. Yeah, but if it wasn't for this and that and this special thing and, you know, climate change or whatever the heck they're going to use an excuse. And I'll guarantee you it comes down to this. individuals are going to advocate for them to make their own decisions about their life, their economy, their business, their education, their abilities to be able to compete, or somebody else is going to do it and see how they allow it.
You know the Constitution like the back of
Thanks,
your hand.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you. Take care. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readersoffreedomsphoenix.com get every day. Readersoffreedomsphoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.